With the holiday shopping season upon us, how about a good book or two for the readers on your Christmas list? I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. It's the 2018 Kansas Notable Books, chosen by the State Library of Kansas. In the first of a two-part series, we'll hear from the authors of many of those books, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. Our first Kansas Notable book may be an unusual choice for a holiday gift. The Man from the Train, The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery, is by Bill James and his daughter, Rachel McCarthy James. A shorter version of this interview was broadcast earlier this year. May 1906, Reverend Ackerman, his wife, and their seven children are brutally murdered in Milton, Florida. October 1911, Ellsworth, Kansas, Will Showman, his wife, and their three children are murdered in their home. June 1912, Villisca, Iowa, Joe and Sarah Moore are murdered along with their four children and two house guests. The connection? The Man on the Train. That's the name of our first Kansas Notable book by Bill James and his daughter Rachel McCarthy James, who dig into dozens of murders in the early 1900s and search for their killer. Bill, Rachel, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
These murders took place over 100 years ago. What drew you to their story now?
I was on the treadmill and on public television in CAT of Kansas City, there was a show about the Villisca murders. It's called Living with a Mystery. It's an excellent documentary, or it would not have made it onto public television. I became interested in them and decided to put an hour into figuring out a little more about them, and then an hour became 2 hours and became 3 hours and eventually became 10 years.
He didn't hire me till halfway through the process, basically, until he'd already written a few chapters, including the first chapter in this book. And he thought that he just needed to, you know, make sure that there were none that he didn't know about.
Right. And a lot of the ones that I initially thought were connected never made it into the book, because while they were often interesting stories, they turned out to be not connected to the series once you understood the series. Once you understood the things that this man did in committing a crime, you realize, you could see clearly that some of the early crimes that I had written up before Rachel joined me actually weren't connected to the series.
It was really remarkable how stark his pattern became after you look at 100 or so murders. Once you look at a lot of these events, it becomes very clear it's much easier for the things you're looking for to stand out. Nobody knows who did it. Done with the back of an axe, done in the middle of the night, large family, things like that. Those hallmarks didn't come along that often. There weren't just families being killed with axes for reasons that for people who were not this guy, basically. So, you know, once you started to understand the pattern, it became clear that we had a lot of work to do, but we knew what work was set out before us, I would say.
You describe these murders in The Man on the Train as being random and yet not random. What do you mean by that? What kinds of things were you looking for?
I would say that the first one that I looked for was the use, beyond just looking at family murders, which I tried to look at pretty much every family murder of a family between 1890 and 1920. The first thing I would look for is the method. The axe used, and specifically the back of the axe used. That was definitely one of his biggest calling cards. He would occasionally use the blade of an axe, but almost always it was the blunt end of the axe. The other things we were looking for were locked doors. That's something that people would often note while describing the scene. The time of day, we would look at where it was and try and figure out, obviously, how far it was from the train, how far it was from train tracks. But in the cases where we had a lot of details, the Cassaways, the first crime, Villisca, obviously. It was really about lining up little details that were too much to deny. Covering all the windows and mirrors, the lamp without the chimney, the makeup of the family, dragging the bodies after death in some cases. And one big distinction that changed from his early crimes to his later crimes, and Dad recognized this early on with the Meadows crime, the first chapter in the book, was he set fire to the house for the first 10 years or so of his rampage. And that's shown from the first crime where he tried to set fire but was unsuccessful in doing so, which is how we have such good information about the positioning of the bodies and other things in the home. When he switched from doing that from about 1898 to 1909 to no longer setting houses on fire, it was another big shift that we looked for in terms of whether he, what kind of families he was targeting. Was he looking at more rural families, or was he, in his later years, 1909 to 1914, he was tending more to stalk small towns where a fire would create a much bigger commotion and would make it harder for him to get away?
You have to understand that the resistance to believing that a crime could have been committed by a random stranger is still strong now, but was much stronger 100 years ago. If there was any way they could 100 years ago interpret a crime as being a something done by a local person, they would. But that wasn't. Go ahead.
They just didn't have a paradigm for serial killers. You know, we all grow up with serial killers. We see stories, documentaries, movies, books about serial killers.
We've heard of serial killers.
We have definitely heard of serial killers.
As your father, I resent your saying that we all grow up with serial
killers. Well, I definitely did, Dad. You had serial killer books all around the house. But they just didn't understand what it was, so they needed... And they needed some way to place this unfathomable tragedy, this horrible, horrible act, and just turn it into something that they can understand. So they looked not to random, you know, this probably fantastical seeming random person who was coming through the country just randomly doing these things. And it was, in a way, random. He would get off, find a family, get back on the train. And that's part of how nobody was able to figure out his pattern. But in order for them to understand it, they had to turn to their communities and turn to the, you know, the little grudges that come up in any life, in any small town, and exploit them so that they could have some peace of mind and some conception of what happened to destroy these towns in many cases.
But also, it's shocking how obvious many of the connections are once you get away from being engulfed in the story. The people who were engulfed in the story could not see that what happened here was just like something that happened 100 miles away 3 months ago. But once you step back, the connections are so obvious. Mm-hmm. For example, the geographical patterns. You mentioned a crime occurs in Kansas, and the next crime occurs in Kansas, and the one after that's in Illinois, and the one after that's in Iowa, and then it's Illinois. And this is a guy who ran coast to coast and north to south, but he's always somewhere. Very rarely are there random, arbitrary jumps.
And these were very clear in his later years when he was basically kind of throwing caution to the wind and killing as many people as he could, basically. It was very clear for that. But the same pattern exists with his earlier crimes, which are in the South, less written about, harder to find out a lot of information about. The same connections exist there. We see the same kind of patterns in the order of his crimes and where they happened.
What were the challenges of investigating murders that took place over 100 years ago?
The biggest challenge was the level of literacy in the South. He committed a lot of murders in the South, and the South at that time had very low levels of literacy, consequently had very few small-town newspapers. So when he committed a crime, when he murdered a family near a small town in the South in 1911, nobody said anything about it, hardly. That's an exaggeration. It would make a newspaper, would be in a few newspaper articles, but it wouldn't set off the ripples that you would expect. So it was hard to document those cases. And some of those cases that occurred in the South in 1909, we really don't have much of a sense of what happened yet, because there's just no newspaper articles that we could find about them.
Again, there was a kind of a sense of clarity, though, in that we just focused on the newspaper reports. We didn't go too in-depth, because there were so many crimes, we couldn't go too in-depth in trying to dig up 100-year-old case files and things like that. We basically relied on the newspapers, because that's how we got we're going to get the most information. And so that's what we kind of focused on. You know, a lot of people have asked us, have you done any FBI profiles of the man from the train? Have you talked to any researchers? And that's a good idea, and that's a worthwhile endeavor, but we haven't because we needed to focus on these newspaper reports and trying to coordinate them and make them into a story. Otherwise, this 500-page book would have been 1,000 pages, and we'd still be working on it, so.
You talk about... in investigating these murders, some of the changes that took place in newspapers and in law enforcement and how...
And technology.
That was a challenge.
The murders occurred over a time span in which America was changing very, very rapidly. So the end of the sequence is very different than the start of the sequence. In 1900... small town newspapers did not subscribe to Associated Press or the UPI or any similar organization. And what happened in a small town stayed there because news didn't travel very well. By 1910 and 1912, when we're writing more about, the wire services were organized and information traveled rapidly around the country, which is apparently what forced the man from the train to decide it was time to leave the United States and go somewhere else because information about what he was doing was chasing him around the country.
People were, you know, we talked earlier about how they didn't have a framework to put these things in with serial killers. But towards the end, it was undeniable that somebody was running around the country killing families. There were just that many happening in that short of a time frame. Paola, Ellsworth, Valeska, Colorado Springs. It was just too much to deny.
Right.
Bill, you're widely known as a writer about baseball. This book is a bit of a departure.
Yeah. Well, I've worked with the Red Sox, for the Boston Red Sox, since 2002. And because I work with the Red Sox, there are a lot of things I can't say about baseball. I mean, there are a lot of things I know about baseball teams that I can't write about publicly anymore. And that gets to be frustrating. So I
can't spill the gossip.
Well, right. So I started looking for something. And as Rachel mentioned, I'm an obsessive reader of crime stories and a watcher of ID television. So it's just something I jumped to.
His previous book, Popular Crime, was also about crime, but right, a lot of different criminals, not just one.
I think that you two are the first and only father-daughter team I've had of Kansas Notable Authors. What was your division of labor like, and what was it like to work with your daughter / your dad?
It worked out a lot better than we would have guessed. First of all, I hired Rachel as a researcher initially, and she became a co-author because she found the guy who was doing this. Basically, I mean, her contributions to the book became too large for her to be just a researcher. So she became a co-author. But it actually worked a lot better than, you know, we have normal father-daughter conflicts and stuff, but really none of that ever surfaced while we were working together.
No, it was really pretty smooth. I would have thought it would. I was a little bit, wasn't sure about it when I was going in, but I needed a job. But then once it became my first book, I was very excited about it. But I did most of the research, which is where I really like to nestle up at old newspapers and see what I can find. But, you know, it worked really well. We would go out to breakfast and talk about it. I never felt like, you know, with some bosses, they'd take all the credit and just mention me in the acknowledgments. Dad obviously didn't do that, and I don't think he would have done that if I was not his daughter, too. And he always listened to whatever I had to say, even if it contradicted his theories, and we would work on them and reach a solution together. Sometimes we disagree about whether a case is, you know, some cases he's like 90% sure on, and I'm like more like 50% sure on. So there we have differences, and I think that is displayed in the book at times. But overall, it worked really well.
Can I get you to read an excerpt from The Man on the Train?
Of course. I found the first crime on a cold January night in 2013. I was not yet an author of this book, just a research assistant. Bill had sent me working backwards through the years, trying to figure out where this series of crimes began. He told me eventually I would find the first crime, and that when the murderer committed the first crime, he would make mistakes that would reveal who he was. I didn't really believe it, and Bill told me later that he didn't really believe it either, but it was a working premise. Maybe you can find the first crime. Maybe he'll leave the door open to tell us who he was. When I began my search for these murders, Bill asked me to focus on the years around the crime in Hurley in 1909-1908. When I asked about looking earlier in the decade, he told me that, for our purposes, a crime in 1899 would be pretty far afield. Even if he found a case, it would be hard to believe he was active that far back. But my gut told me that he was already well-practiced by 1909, so Bill let me follow my hunch. I used 1900 as my beginning point and started combing through newspapers in those years for the reports of families murdered in the night. Soon enough, I found the Lyerleys, the Hughes, the Hodges, the Kellys or Caffeys, the Allens. I knew his crimes went back to nearly 1900, but I hadn't found the blueprint.
That's Rachel McCarthy James reading from The Man on the Train. Bill, can I get you to read an excerpt?
Oh, well, I can just read the whole book. I'm just kidding. In Kansas in the 19th century, there were 200 documented lynchings, all of them of persons believed to have committed crimes. The actual number of lynched persons is 200, not 199 or 201 rounded off to 200. The number of separate events is somewhat less. In the 20th century, there were six such cases, three of those from 1900 to 1912. By 1912, when these murders occurred, lynching had essentially ended in Kansas, but was part of the state's recent history. A lynching is, of course, the ultimate example of an inappropriate involvement of the public in the process of justice. We might expect, then, that when there were so many extremely inappropriate interactions between the public and the process of justice, there would also be many other inappropriate, if less dramatic, interactions between the public and the process of justice.
That's Bill James, and before that, his daughter, Rachel McCarthy James. They're the co-authors of The Man from the Train, The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery. It's just one of the 15 books chosen by the State Library of Kansas as the 2018 Kansas Notable Books. Today and next week on KPR Presents, we'll be talking to the authors of many of those Kansas Notable Books. Kansas Public Radio has several Kansas Notable Books to give away. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, go to our website, kansaspublicradio.org, and look under Extras and Available Giveaways.
Okay, now remember, I can't sing, but I'll give it a try.
With that disclaimer, go to it.
Cricket in the thicket, cricket in the house, cricket in the bedroom, not as quiet as a mouse, cricket in the closet, in a pocket or a shoe. Cricket, 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 where are you?
That's Cricket in the Thicket, the title poem in a book by that name by Carol Murray of Overland Park. Carol, thank you so much for visiting with me today.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
This book is a collection of poems about insects.
Right.
But it's not just poems, it's also other information about those insects. Tell me about how you came to put this book together.
Well, it's a book that's poetry and it's nonfiction as well, so that the idea is that you have some fun, but you also learn a lot. And there are arachnids and crustaceans and mostly insects in this book. So I know a lot about bugs just because I've lived in Kansas all my life. And the book's dedicated to my two sons who are now grown. But I asked them what their favorite bugs were, and they are grasshopper green, inchworm, and the firefly, which didn't surprise me, though they used to love to play with roly-poly bugs too. But I wrote the poems, and then the editor that I worked with, Christy Ottaviano at Holt, is the one that suggested I put factoids on each page. And also, we ended up putting a pretty extensive glossary in the back of the book. So you can learn something while you're reading this book to your kids. And they can learn something too. It's a lot of fun.
Can you talk to me about your creative process?
Well, I love poetry. I love it. And I've studied poetry, and I taught at Hutch Community College for quite a few years as an adjunct professor, so I still had time to write. So I've written all my life. Our family used to write poems back and forth, like many of you all probably do, for special occasions. So it's always been a part of my life. But to get a poetry book published, you really need to have a narrative arc as well as a theme. So I just started writing about bugs, and then we arranged the book so that it goes from morning till night. And that, you know, that's the way the book works. There are 29 poems, some about good bugs, some about not so good bugs. So, and it's got a lot of humor in it, which I like. And it's also got some heart in it, which I also like. So I think that's a great combination.
You mentioned that your favorite bug is the ladybug.
Yes.
Can I get you to read the poem about ladybugs and tell me a little bit about them?
Oh, okay. Sure, I'll read Ladybug. It's called Ladybug Hug. Everyone loves the ladybug. She's cute and small and shy. A bright, delightful, friendly sort and pleasing to the eye. A charming little creature bringing polka-dotted fun. So should you want to hug a bug, this lady is the one. But I love the factoid on this, too. Surprise! That ladybug may actually be male. It's hard to tell. Ladybugs are said to be good luck. A gardener's helper, ladybugs rid the garden of aphids, which can damage plants. So, did you know that there were male ladybugs?
I guess I assume that there must be.
Yeah, there have to be. But anyway, so I tried to have a little surprises in these poems, and a lot of fun, and then some facts.
Carol, can I have you go out on another poem?
Well, the last poem is The Firefly's Song.
Excellent.
I'll sing it. This is the Firefly finale. We glitter and glimmer and put on a show in honor of Earth. Come and share our glow. We glitter and glimmer, put on a show in honor of Earth. Let's glow in honor of Earth. Let's glow. So it's very short, but I like the message it gives. We glitter and glimmer and put on a show in honor of Earth. Come and share in our glow.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
Carol, thank you so much for sharing your poetry with us today, and congratulations on being named a Kansas Notable winner.
You're very welcome. I'm thrilled. I love Kansas, and I'm very happy to be a part of this. So thank you very much.
I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, it's the 2018 Kansas Notable Books, Part 1. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 Kansas Notable Books, including children's books like Cricket in the Thicket, nonfiction like The Man from the Train, and poetry like our next book. It's Feet of the Messenger by H.C. Palmer of Lenexa.
Back from the tour in Afghanistan, the soldier says, "Half my foot is gone, Doc, but I'm still in the guard. A peacetime soldier now." I take his foot, a stub grafted at the arch, trace the spongy edges with my fingers. "No feeling," he laughs. "Beautiful work, don't you think?" He tells me his boot was blown off by an RPG. They were isolated 5 days in a valley called Korngal. No LZ for a medevac, So the medic dressed his wound, then commandeered a boot from a body bag, searching four bags for one that fit. That boot smelled of rotten flesh, but it was a gift from heaven, he said. That and a little morphine let me stand to fight. I take his good foot, compare side to side, before and after, recalling a scripture. Perhaps these feet, I say. He asks, what do you mean? And I say, Isaiah. It was Isaiah who said, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messenger who announces peace.
That's Dr. H.C. Palmer of Lenexa reading from his first book of poetry, Feet of the Messenger. Welcome, H.C.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Many of the poems in your collection reflect on your time serving in the Vietnam War. Take us back to 1964 and how your experience as an Army doctor has found its way into your writing.
Well, I was drafted in 1964 from my residency after 1 year of residency from KU, along with 1,500 other doctors. When I got back, 2 years later, after a year at Fort Riley and a year in Vietnam, the head of the Department of Internal Medicine, Dr. Malin Delp, who has a building named after him, is my favorite doctor of all time, sat across me at his desk on my first day back, which was like 2 days after I'd landed in Kansas City from Saigon, Saigon, San Francisco, Kansas City. And he looked at me, and I remember looking over his shoulder behind him at pictures on the wall above his credenza. And there was a photograph of him there at the Battle of the Bulge. He was a colonel in the hospital there. And he's standing there with his arms crossed looking at the camera, a pretty impressive figure. And he looked at me and he said, H.C., is there anything you want to talk about? And I truthfully was too stupid to understand he was giving me an opportunity to talk about the war. And I said, no, I'm just glad to get back. So that sort of set the tone for the next several years. I just put the war behind me. Probably 1995, I decided I wanted to write fly fishing stories because my wife and I are both fly fish. And the second story I wrote, a Vietnam vet appeared in it. And I had no intention of doing that. This guy turned out to be a Vietnam vet because he had some things he wanted to do and he needed to have a reason to do it. So I went ahead and wrote that story and some other stories. And including more about Vietnam, and especially the wall, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., which is a beautiful place, a wonderful place, a terrible place. And I went to a writing workshop in Squaw Valley, and a poet named Gary Snyder read a poem there. And I realized after he read this poem called Hay for the Horses that he had told a man's story in about 150 words, his entire life story in 150 words. And that piqued my interest in writing poems. And then I started some years later writing a poem. And the first poem I wrote and got published was in the Flint Hills Review, Emporia State University Press. And it was about hunting with my dog down in the Flint Hills. And it's the first poem in the book. And a covey of quail got up, and I shot this bird that was closest and blew her apart, a little hen. And when I picked her up, her feathers were all blown off. Her skin was blown off. It was blood and guts and sticky stuff, and I couldn't get it off. And I can recall some times, two or three times, that I was applying pressure to our guys who had had wounds to stop bleeding, and how the threads of the cloth of the jungle fatigue stuck to my fingers. And that's the first poem in the book, and that was the first poem I wrote. I had not written any poems until then. Good to write about it.
Could you read that poem for us?
Sure. This poem is called Bird Hunting in the Tall Grass. Shot at close range, the little hen has come apart. Her feathers, wet with her blood, cling to my fingers. I probe the femoral artery where fragments of the sergeant's fatigues penetrate the wound. After it's over, and for a long time, I pick at my fingers, threads in congealed blood. On my knees beside the spring creek, I wash the feathers away.
Not all of your poems in Feet of the Messenger are about war and Vietnam. You write beautifully about Kansas and the landscape here. I'm wondering if you could read the poem Tide.
Yeah, Tide, for me, was one of the most fun poems that I wrote because of my dad. And I raised registered cattle for years, and my dad had a couple of milk cows when we were a kid. And I remember in 1948, there was a supermoon. And my dad took me out in this little five-acre pasture where we had the milk cows, and we watched it come up. And so we really did spend some time looking at the cow herd at night. And this poem's called Tide, and it occurs during a time of a supermoon when the moon is at perigee, which is closest to the earth, and the sun is in line with that. So these are king tides or super tides. And my father always was a man of the land, and he loved what was below him, the soil, the rocks, and so forth, and believed, of course, rightfully so, that we owe a lot to the land and how it got here. The name of this poem is Tide. And there's an epigraph from Jim Harrison, who just died a year ago, who's one of my very favorite American writers and maybe one of the best ever American writers and poets. And the epigraph says, "The earth was forcing me not to forget her." Tide. My father believed the bedrock beneath our ranch, once an immense sea, was still alive. That natural rhythms persisted in its sluggish consolidation. He taught me to listen for echoes of breaking surf, but I couldn't hear them. Even at night, with the wind quiet and my ear pressed to an outcropping, he believed the gravitational pull of a full perigee moon could still move the old limestone. He called it land tide. I thought that, too, improbable, until one night the moon rose so full of light we could have counted the calves in our pasture. Then, when its bottom edge caught the crest of a hill, and just as I felt the prairie lift an inch sideways beneath my feet, he said, "There, that's it." I have never recovered from that night or the weight of his hand on my shoulder.
That's H.C. Palmer of Lenexa reading from his book, Feet of the Messenger. H.C., thank you so much for sharing these with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. H.C. Palmer was one of 12 Vietnam veterans featured in Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War, broadcast last month on KPR Presents. If you missed that program, it's archived at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. KPR has a copy of Feet of the Messenger by H.C. Palmer. If you'd like a chance to win this or another Kansas Notable book, go to our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Check under Extras and Available Giveaways. I'm Kay McIntyre. We'll hear from more Kansas Notable authors coming up right after this. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. If you own a smart speaker like the Amazon Alexa, you've got yet another way to enjoy Kansas Public Radio. All you have to do is tell your smart speaker to enable the KPR skill. Then anytime you want to listen, just say, "Play KPR." It's that easy. You don't need an antenna or a radio, just a good Wi-Fi connection.
Support for KPR comes from the Lecompton Historical Society's Christmas in Lecompton. Over 168 Christmas trees with vintage and antique ornaments at the Territorial Capital Museum now until the new year. Details at lecomptonkansas.com.
You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Kay McIntyre. If you're just joining us today on KPR Presents, it's the 2018 Kansas Notable Books, Part 1. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books by Kansas authors or about Kansas. Our next Kansas notable author is Meryl Crabtree of Mission. She reads from her book of poetry, Fireflies in the Gathering Dark.
A testimony of Western Kansas hamlets. Thick-limbed, sturdy-tongued, the young thoroughly churched in elders' ways, but not afraid to add their own. Midwestern gesture of two-fingered hand waves from passing trucks, gaze squinting against an open sun. Coffee, plaid shirts with pockets, jeans that still huddle close to the waist. Socks in all seasons, wind and dust play their perpetual tunes. Piano of brown and gold, keys in a flatland orchestra of wheat and cottonwoods, conducted in God's time.
That's a testimony of Western Kansas hamlets by Meryl Crabtree of Mission. Meryl, thank you so much for coming into KPR today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Are there common threads that run through your poems?
Yes, and I think the title sort of refers to that because I see the fireflies. Of course, there are the fireflies we all remember as children chasing around in the dark, and they were always magical to me. But to me, it's a metaphor also for the sparks of light that inspire us all the time. Different sparks for different people. But in this book, I've tried to gather some poems that talk about things that might inspire people. And part of that, of course, is the Kansas landscape. I'm almost a native Kansan. I came here at the age of 17 to go to college and have lived here ever since. And, you know, Western Kansas is one of my favorite places to be. So there are some poems that are kind of home place poems about Kansas. But there are also other poems that explore the bigger questions of inner landscapes, if you will, that most of us who've lived on Earth for a while do eventually get around to exploring.
Can you share one of those poems with me?
Okay. I was in Ireland about 4 years ago and was really, you know, so struck with, actually, there's a similarity in the feeling that the landscape gives you in Ireland, or gave me, and the feeling I get when I'm out in the western part of our state where things are just so windswept and so open. And wrote this poem when I was hiking in the hills of Ireland, and just came to me, and it's called Irish Lullaby for the End of the World. When the last of the stars winks out, when time's constant hum falls silent, with the last breath of midnight, we'll pipe the old tunes and whistle the jigs. Fingers will snap and brogues will click, and we'll find each other in the dark. And to me, that's what the best of poetry can do for us, is to connect us. And so that's, I think that's what I tried to do with this whole book, was to find ways of connecting with people, with landscapes, with relationships, with the past, with whatever is out there.
One of the poems that really connected for me was on the very next page, In My Mother's House. Hmm. Could you read that for me, please?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. In my mother's house, stacked ceiling high, boxes neatly labeled, quilt scraps, old clothes, tablecloths, everything has its place. It's as if she believes that as long as her shelves are full, she won't die. Meanwhile, I try to sort things out. I bring home bowls, four little ones, one big one, things I don't need and don't want. Nevertheless, it's five fewer things in her house and five more in mine. Before I die, may my rooms be empty, picked clean as old bones. May I have the courage to wear last year's dresses, find comfort in old books, let go, and say a clear goodbye.
I think for anyone who's lost a parent or who has helped a parent go through their possessions, this poem is very powerful.
Yeah, and the poem is actually from a real experience that I had with not so much my mother, who died much younger, but my mother-in-law, who became like a mother to me. And so we helped her over a number of years get to the place emotionally and psychologically where she was ready to let go of a few things. But now I'm facing that same downsizing dilemma myself, and it's just a tough one.
You don't just communicate through your poetry. You're also very active on social media and Twitter. Tell me about your project, Can Poetry Save the World?
Yes, well, I don't know exactly what inspired the question, but I was asked as part of the Kansas Notables presentation I'm going to be doing, I was asked to give them a topic. And so out popped this question, can or will poetry save the world? And I thought, well, gosh, I'd better start thinking about that. So what I have started doing as a project for me and for others, if they want to join, certainly, is to put a few lines of poetry or quote about poetry on Twitter every day with hashtag poetry can save the world. And it's really been a centering exercise for me. It really puts me right there with the poems that I love that speak to me. But I really hope that other people will also take the opportunity to put some poetry on there, and we'll see where that goes.
Meryl, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Meryl Crabtree of Mission is the author of Fireflies in the Gathering Dark. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we're hearing from many of the 2018 Kansas Notable winners, including Romlyn Tillman of Long Beach, California. Her debut novel, To the Stars Through Difficulties, pays tribute to Kansas libraries and the women who made them possible. This interview previously aired on KPR Presents in October 2017. To the Stars Through Difficulties tells the story of three women, Angelina, Tracy Ash, and Gail. Talk to me about those three women and those characters as you see them.
Well, they've come to Kansas. Well, they're in Kansas for three different reasons. Angelina has come to work on her PhD dissertation, which is on the Carnegie Libraries. There were 59 Carnegie Libraries built in Kansas in the early 1910s, and she's been fascinated by them. She's been struggling with this dissertation for over 10 years, and she just has to get it done. Tracy Ash is a very challenged personality. She's an artist. She was found in a trash bin on Times Square as a newborn, just hours old, and was adopted out and has never really felt at home or had any kind of loving atmosphere. And then Gail, her house, in fact, her entire community has been wiped out by a tornado. So they end up together at the New Hope Arts Center with a bunch of quilters, and that's where they start interacting.
So the book, as you say, opens with an F5 tornado that destroys the town of New Hope, Kansas. To what extent was this story modeled after Greensburg, Kansas?
A lot. But I have to tell you, I was probably 4 years into it before the Greensburg tornado happened. And so Gail was the newest character who was added. Now, that's a secret now that all of your listeners know. But certainly all of the information about the tornado came from Greensburg.
So talk to me about how does that tornado act as a catalyst to bring this story together?
Well, the thing that was really important for me was to be able to show it as a contemporary story, that even though it was these communities in 1910s that had fascinated me, I wanted people to really understand that even today, we all need to get together and build community. And so that was the sermon part of it, if you will. And so I really wanted that component. And the most dramatic way to do that is with a crisis. And of course, this week as we're sitting here with hurricanes all around us, we see the validity of that.
The town of New Hope, there's a quote in your book that some would say it's in the middle of nowhere, but we prefer the center of everything. I'm just curious, was that an allusion to Laura Moriarty's book?
Not consciously, although I certainly love her book and I read it. But I have seen a few other references along the way, and I think it's just such a wonderful comparison.
So tell me what that means to be in the middle of nowhere versus the center of everything.
I think it's, my book is a lot about self-esteem and how we think of ourselves and how we think of our places in the world. And I think that sometimes Kansans, and I'm one of them, can come across as being defensive about where we live and our decisions to be here. And other times we realize that we, you know, and I'm not living in Kansas now, I'm in Southern California, but that we have a groundedness that comes from having been raised in Kansas that really does make us the center of everywhere.
The town's library, which is a Carnegie library, is really at the center of this story. Tell me how those Carnegie libraries came about in Kansas, and what was the role of women in making that happen?
Well, that's the essence of the book. And they happened one by one. Interested women or interested people in a community, but they were mostly women, would come together and approach Andrew Carnegie for a grant to build a library in their communities. But there wasn't any statewide effort particularly, although there was a Kansas Library Association that would help them find how to do that. But it was one by one. These communities would determine that that's what they wanted. They would write him a letter. And the community itself had to pledge to provide the land and to provide 10 years worth of operating expenses, which those 10 years would add up to the total of the grant that was given to the community. And then he would only give $2 to $3 per person. So a few communities kind of stretched their population numbers to make sure they got the maximum amount of money from him. But there were 59 of them built in the state, which I think is just, you know, incredible.
You grew up in Kansas, you attended KU, but you now live in California. Why come back to Kansas for your first novel?
Oh, it's still in every cell of my body. Kansas is, you know, is very definitely there. And like I said, this story has just stayed with me. That was a very important part of my life, and I think that it's a very fascinating era. I think the way Kansans make things happen is unique, and I really wanted to tell that story.
Can I get you to read a passage from your book?
Okay, this comes from the very beginning. It's in the voice of Angelina. As you know, there are three voices. And Angelina is coming back largely because she fell in love with this Carnegie Library as a child, and that's been the inspiration for her dissertation. So I'm reading from her very first entrance into Kansas. I've been fascinated by Carnegie Library since my first and only visit to Kansas, that trip to visit my father's mother over 3 decades ago. What I remember most is reading Little House on the Prairie with my father. We sat close to look at the drawings. My memories smell of sunshine, because when we were in Kansas, my father always changed his shirt before he read to us, and that shirt had always spent the day flying on a clothesline outside. What I remember most about the book are Conestoga wagons. Conestoga wagons filled with families, leaving everything behind to start anew. Back then, more than anything, I wanted to be Laura, to wear pigtails, play with corncob dolls, drink from a tin cup, and win spelling bees. The Halloween after our visit, I convinced my teacher to help me construct a pioneer girl's costume, a bonnet made from a round Quaker oatmeal carton, and a calico skirt held in place with a hula hoop. I could hardly walk in that hula hoop, and I wanted to run away from home. When I dreamed of running away from home, I dreamed of running to Kansas. It was grandmother who told me Andrew Carnegie built 59 libraries in Kansas in the early 1900s. Before he was done, he'd spent $875,000 in communities that donated the land and committed to raising 10% of the capital costs for ongoing operations of a public library. As I look at the wide-open space, it's hard to imagine how a literary movement would have taken hold here at the turn of the 20th century. Grandmother described Carnegie as a benevolent Johnny Appleseed kind of guy, and it was only later that I discovered his despicable treatment of mine workers, including the murder of 7 men in his attempt to break up the union. A few Kansas communities refused to take his tainted money even for the promise of a library. Should we or should we not forgive and forget? Was he redeemed because he gave the country 1,689 libraries that served 34 million people by 1919? I became fascinated by this man who was both a philanthropist and robber baron, obsessed as if he'd been a bad boy boyfriend. On the one hand, he believed the wealthy should live without extravagance and give away their excess money to promote the welfare and happiness of the common man. On the other hand, he was shrewd to the point of ruthlessness. My grandmother talked about the man as if she'd known him personally. She was as proud of that library as if she'd built it herself. Once she thumped her journal and said, "The story is in here," but she wouldn't let me read it. "Not now," she said. "It's a secret."
That's Romilyn Tillman reading from To the Stars Through Difficulties. We've got one last Kansas notable book to go this week. That Is My Dream traces the day of a young African-American boy facing segregation and discrimination, juxtaposed with a beautiful message of hope. The book is illustrated by Daniel Miaris of Lenexa and based on a poem by Langston Hughes. Daniel, how did you come to this poem?
Well, That Is My Dream is based on Dream Variation by Langston Hughes. And, you know, partly it started with my artist rep, Judy Sue Goodwin Sturgis. She said, "Have you ever heard of this poem?" And I said, I love Langston Hughes's work, but I've never read this poem. And I went and looked it up and it just kind of knocked me back. And I said, okay, you know, I need to think about this. And I spent some time thinking about it. But then really what I was doing was kind of revisiting, you know, why Hughes's work was so powerful to me, right? And I had to kind of walk back in my life. And I went all the way back to when I was a teenager and English class in high school. And we were studying the Harlem Renaissance, and that was the first time I had ever come across Langston Hughes's work. And the first poem I had ever read of his was Theme for English B. And, you know, here I was, this angst-ridden kid, you know, kind of a closet poet, you know, like to get my emotions out through poetry, but didn't want anybody to know. I was an art kid. I was more comfortable expressing myself with pictures. But then there was this poem about this kid, you know, processing, you know, his place in this world through this assignment. But the way Langston Hughes used words to kind of cut to the quick, it really peeled back this facade that I don't even know if I was fully aware of how it existed in people's lives. And I felt like, you know, all at once empowered, but kind of ashamed, you know, for not having that experience myself, you know. And it's like, oh my gosh, here he was using all the same words I knew, you know, in a way that could really cut to the core of a kid like me. I understood the power of poetry through that. So anyway, that was the, it didn't take much for me to say, okay, you know, I've got something here that I want to go after. But I immediately thought of, you know, why would I do this? Why me? You know, I'm not African American. I'm not, he's not speaking, you know, alongside of me. He might be speaking to me, you know, like, how do you change your level of empathy? How do you understand what I'm going through? You know, maybe that's what he's saying to me. But I immediately thought of my children. And I think of a lot of other children. And me as a child, when I was a teenager, that feeling of, wow, you know, I needed the facade kind of peeled back, knocked down, pulled away. And I thought, well, that's my dream for my children. You know, that they, a lot earlier than I learned as a kid growing up in South Carolina, that, you know, not everyone's experiences are like your own. And the more you can internalize that and understand, then I think we have hope. So that's the whys, you know, that's the big question mark for me. And that allowed me to jump into this project and say, I'm all in, and come what may. And I think for me it felt like a bit of a risk, you know, to pick content like this, but it's too important not to. And these are the kinds of stories that I can either lie awake at night thinking about, or I can stay up at night and make them. And this was one of them. You know, you can't turn it down. You can't turn away from it. So,
Daniel, your contribution to this project is obviously the illustrations, but can you read the poem for us and then pick out a picture and describe what's happening?
Okay. This is Dream Variation by Langston Hughes, as a picture book called That Is My Dream by me and Langston Hughes. To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream, to fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl till the quick day is done, rest at pale evening a tall slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me.
That's That Is My Dream by Langston Hughes, read by Daniel Miaris of Lenexa. Daniel, can you describe one of the illustrations you've done for this book?
Yeah, so, well, how about I do two?
Okay.
So as the poem builds, you know, this young boy and his family are meeting up to have dinner at this park, kind of a picnic, and then this bird, the boy has this bird on his hand, has come and landed on his hand, and then when the line comes, that is my dream, the boy is throwing his arm up and the bird is flying away, and then it immediately transitions to the next spread where it says, to fling my arms wide, and this is the second time we hear that, in the face of the sun. This time the boy is flinging his arms wide, but he, his sister, and two other children are flying on these larger-than-life birds in the glow of the sun over the park itself. Kind of they're taking off on this magical journey. And, you know, for me, I think this is one of the most important parts of the book, where there's that, you know, that transition that, you know, the boy's struggling with all these feelings and thoughts about what's going on and why I'm living this way, but they're living that way. And then at this point, it becomes this great kind of equalized moment, and he's leading the way on his trusty steed of a bird. And, you know, I like the exuberance of that, and that was really important to make that transition, you know, kind of abruptly.
That's Daniel Miaris of Lenexa, one of the authors honored this year by the State Library of Kansas. That Is My Dream, To the Stars Through Difficulties, Fireflies in the Gathering Dark, Feet of the Messenger, Cricket in the Thicket, and The Man from the Train. That's all the time we have today for the 2018 Kansas Notable Books, and we've still got plenty to go. Join us next week on KPR Presents when we'll talk to more of this year's Kansas Notable authors. We'll hear about the role of President Eisenhower during the McCarthy era and a look at the golden age of baseball in the Sunflower State. We've got several Kansas Notable books to give away. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, go to our website, kansaspublicradio.org, look under Extras and Available Giveaways. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.